3 that it was the meeting we hosted here where we sought to look into the Bible for parables, biblical analogies that are in the things that we witness around us, experience around us. And it seems that this is it's often occurring in the Bible where God will use such experiences, things that we might witness, taste, see, feel, hear, and then make a biblical application out of them. They come from places like nature and business and relationships, both of a marital variety and then of platonic relationships. So they're all around us, these things that God uses to draw out his spiritual applications. And many, if not most times, the actual observation you make is very common sense oriented. And maybe the spiritual truth is what eludes us, though. An example, raise your hand, please do. Raise your hand if you think it's a good idea to walk up to bear cubs and mess around with them. Okay. If you're old enough to be in a position to see bear cubs, then you're probably old enough to realize that's a very bad idea. And yet, this is how the Bible reminds us uses that as an analogy, rather, to remind us of our associations. This is in Proverbs 17:12. Let a man meet a bear robbed of her cubs rather than a fool in his folly. It's pretty strong, but maybe not so obvious. I can tell you, I would never mess with a bear cub, but I can tell you many times in my life I've gotten wrapped up with foolish people doing foolish things. Why do I expect anything different than the same disastrous outcome as a mother bear coming back? These are the examples I'm talking about where God uses animals to make his spiritual applications. They're all around us, animals. We see them, especially here in Arizona. The variety is immense with all the different types of birds and coyotes, javelina, snakes, bobcats, mountain lions, and things we have as pets, like dogs and cats and whatever else you may have as your pet. The second, bear was the first example. The second example I'd like to talk about are birds. And birds are one of the few animals I can think of where there's actually a group of people devoted to watching them, right? People go way off into remote areas to go with binoculars and field guidebooks and what have you to watch birds. I will say, I would probably never do that, but I will say that I do miss the area I grew up in because there were some really colorful birds there, like male cardinals, for instance, or blue jays, things you don't particularly see too much here in Phoenix. But even here in Phoenix, roadrunners are kind of cool to watch. And I see quite a bit of hawks where I live, actually, too. But they all, hummingbirds. Hummingbirds are like a year-round occurrence here in Arizona. I will say I do kind of enjoy seeing them and watching them and seeing them interact in whatever environment they're in. But Christ actually used birds to make at least one, actually in other passages I'm not going to, but here in this passage he uses a bird. He says, this is in Matthew 6, verse 25, for this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you'll eat or what you'll drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? Birds are not what you think about. They don't they don't have retirement accounts. They're not worried about 3 months down the road. They're worried about today and gathering the food they need for today. And as a general rule, that's how they operate. They don't worry too much, do they? But in another example, in another context, Christ, what does he say about the sparrow, Is it 5 sparrows for 2 pennies? I believe it is. They're cheap. They're almost worth nothing monetarily, but yet God considers them. He provides for them, and yet you're worth much more. So there's no need to worry. And the bird is the example we have. And I encourage you to look into more birds. I mentioned the sparrow. I believe Isaiah, is he the one that talks about the eagle? I believe Job actually mentions the eagle as well. So more to study regarding birds and how birds are, their behaviors have spiritual applications for us. But the next animal I'd like to look into is the horse. A horse, huge animal. They're a graceful animal, but you got to admit that it probably takes quite a bit of money and effort to take care of a horse, doesn't it not? They're huge animals. They have to eat a lot, and they have to be exercised and whatnot. So why would you have a horse? Well, today you may have him as a pet, but I'm talking in the ancient world up until the last few hundred years. Horses, especially horses in large numbers that you might have, are for either displaying your military power or for an industrial might. The British Shire horse, for instance, it's a modern breed, but the top end of that horse, it weighs about 2,500 pounds. It's more than a Mazda Miata. The largest Shire on record was back in the 1800s named Samson, 21.2 hands tall. It's over 7 feet tall. And he weighed estimated 3,360 pounds. That's more like a Honda Accord size. Massive animal, okay? And in the past 100 years, I found this on history.com, 10 million people died during World War I. And according to this statistic, 8 million horses died in World War I. One day in a battle in France in 1916, 7,000 horses died. So you can see the horses up until very recently are very prevalent in the industrial side. That's why the British bred these large horses. And in the military side, thousands of horses, millions of horses used in war. They're used for carrying soldiers and supplies and weaponry. But even Moses, way back thousands of years ago, knew about this too. Moses said this in Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. When you enter the land which the Lord God gives you, and you possess it, and you live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. You shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. Nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Money mentioned right here, silver and gold. Influence and alliances with the multiple wives that a king may choose. What about the horses? Why stockpile horses? And again, of course, the horses here were Egyptian horses, perhaps. Why would you stockpile horses unless you were trying to build yourself up as some mighty industrial power or as a military might? There's no reason to have that many horses other than to do that. So hundreds of years later, Prophet Isaiah would pick up on this. And he kind of would mock the hubris that the people of God had developed over the years. In Isaiah 2, verse 6, he says, "For you have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob, because they are filled with influences from the east, and they are soothsayers like the Philistines, and they strike bargains with children of foreigners. Their land has also been filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land has been filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots." They were doing almost point for point exactly what Moses was warning a future king against. And there they were, stockpiling horses and chariots. The best, perhaps, passage I can think of in the entire Bible regarding horses is not the children of God's horses, but actually God himself, he had horses. And this happened in 2 Kings. The king of Aram couldn't figure out, he thought he had a leaker, and turns out he just had a prophet of God that knew everything he was going to do. So he's like, oh, I got to go get this guy. His name was Elisha. So he goes to get Elisha, and Elisha and his servant was, his faith was shaken. And Elisha asked God, actually this is how it goes this is 2 Kings 6, verse 15. Now when the attendant of the man of God had risen early and gone out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was circling the city. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? So he answered, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Then Elisha prayed, O Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when he came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, strike the people with blindness, I pray. Of course, you probably know that story. Elisha treated those people very well and with kindness, but he did defeat them. And he defeated them not with his own physical animals and instruments of war. He defeated him with the armies of God that were there protecting him. So that's the lesson of the horse right there. Who do you trust in? The next lesson is about an enemy and a friend, and that's the lesson of the lion. Peter says this in 1 Peter 5. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on him, because he cares for you. Be of sober spirit, be on the alert. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. But resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experiences of suffering are being accomplished by your brethren who are in the world. After you have suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. The image is strong here, because when we are not humble, and when we are anxious, and we don't wait on God, we're almost like a wounded animal that the lion's going to go and pick off. That's when the prey is the most vulnerable, is when it's wounded, or when it's weak and gets separated from its whatever group of animals it associates with. That's when the lion can pick it off. The way out of being in the path of that lion is with humility, patience, and putting away anxiety, and being aware that your enemy looks for you. But the Bible doesn't always speak of lions in that bad association. John found this out in the scene unfolding in heaven. It says this in Revelation 5. I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a book written inside and on the back, sealed up with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and break its seals? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the book and to look into it. Then I began to weep greatly, because no one was found worthy to open the book or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals. And I saw between the throne with four living creatures and the elders a lamb standing as if slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he came and he took the book out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb, each one holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, worthy are you to take the book of the set and break its seals, for you were slain and purchased of God with your blood men from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. He's a lion and a lamb. Well, the devil was like a lion, but Jesus is a lion. Why a lion and a lamb? I tell you, this probably deserves a lot more time. This probably deserves a lot of class. This is the book of the Revelation, after all. And it's maybe rightfully so, maybe not rightfully so, intimidating to come and study. But I'll tell you one thing I can say in this very short amount of time as I considered this. The lamb, that animal, is used all throughout the Old Testament up until the New, representing the sacrifices. But the lion himself is the animal of strength. And I bet you in actual nature, the lion gets bested here and there. But as a rule, the lion is chief. It's an apex predator. There's no one after the lion. The lion is the strength. And there was no one there to open, to break those seals on the book of God. But the strength of Jesus, the lion side of him, and his sacrifice, the lamb side of him, that was the one ticket to break those seals and open that book of God. So, the image of the lion. And lastly, what do you think I've missed? What animal? Anybody? How about the dog? I'm a dog guy. I've had 5 dogs in my life. 2 Welsh Corgis and 2 long-haired Dachshunds and 1 short-haired Dachshund. And as I looked back on my interaction with dogs, I realized that some few months ago, I realized that every dog I've ever had looks like a kind of like a tube sock with short feet. But that's just that's the dogs I've had. I love dogs. I love animals. But I'll tell you, I looking at my own self, I think that I'm still in the realm of the normal people. Okay, I haven't gone so far. You've met those people that have gone, you know, way over the top. I'm up there, but I think I've stopped short of it. But I'll say this: with my dogs, the current 2 I have, I work to keep the dachshunds. I try to keep them fairly trim, because if you get them obese, then you get issues with their spine later on. But they still know something instinctively, and they know mealtime. Their nose works very well. Of course, it's that long on the dachshund, but they know when it's time to eat, and they come in there. And of course, we as a general rule, we don't give them the bad food for them, but they still expect it, and they're still looking for it. And if you drop it, it's gone, right? And then when you pull all 3 of my kids that I've over the years have fed in the same high chair, the dog, I mean, they're long. They can get up, and then they can have another foot and a half of tongue that they can go, and you know, they're doing the tongue up, scraping anything they can get off. Dogs know how to go and collect food. And this point, Jesus had an interaction with a Canaanite woman. Some translations call her a Syrophoenician woman. Jesus had an interaction with a woman who had a daughter who was demon-possessed. In fact, she came to him, this is in Matthew 15, verse 22. She came to him and said, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is cruelly demon-possessed." But he did not answer her a word. And his disciples came and implored him, saying, "Send her away, because she keeps shouting at us." But he answered and said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she came, and she began to bow down before him, saying, "Lord, help me." And he answered and said, "It is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she said, "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs feed on the crumbs which fall from their master's table." It must be a truism that has lasted millennia. And it was right there obvious to no one but Jesus and her. Of course, it was after that, because Jesus said, "O woman, your faith is great. It shall be done for you as you wish," and her daughter was healed at once. That's awesome faith right there. To come up with that on the spur of the moment. God says, or Jesus, God, says, I can't throw the good bread for Israel into the dogs. She's like, just whatever crumbs fall from heaven, that's good enough for me. And she knew that's all she needed. And that's pretty awesome, I think. And again, it's an observation you can make about an animal around you that God has taken to make a spiritual application out of. But everybody knows, except for those people I mentioned a minute ago, everybody knows that there's even a limit with dogs. They have a disgusting side and some very disgusting traits. Sometimes I have to give my dogs a moratorium. You got 30 minutes before you lick me again, right? But they often do disgusting things, and the Bible picks up on this as well. First picked up by Solomon in the book of Proverbs, chapter 26 and verse 21, he says, like a dog that returns to its vomit is a fool who repeats his folly. It's actually disgusting, but it's true. Most of us have seen a dog do that before. I don't know why. I mean, that's just the instinct that's bred into them. But they do that. They vomit, and then they go and they eat it right again. And as bad as it sounds in the Old Testament when it's mentioned there, it sounds pretty bad. Peter picks up on it and actually, to me, makes even a stronger point here in 2 Peter 2. Peter talking about the whole book of 2 Peter, it's hard really to break into any passage and potentially miss the context. And 2 Peter is almost one of those books that there's not really a good piece to pull out. But here, he's talking about, well, he warns them all throughout the book. And he's in the midst of warning them about people who would pervert the gospel and change it and drive people away and tempt them to go away and just all sorts of bad things that people might do to have people fall away. And he mentions the angels and the flood and Sodom and how God is really adept at picking who he wants to save and who he doesn't. God can rescue, in fact, this is the quote from Peter, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment. That's in reference to the angels and to the flood and to Sodom. But this is what he explains about these people. This is how he describes it. These people, they're daring, they're self-willed. This is actually 2 Peter 2, and this is verse 10, I think, here. They're daring, they're self-willed. They do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties. Whereas angels who are greater in might and power do not bring a reviling judgment against them before the Lord. But these, like unreasoning animals, again, an animal example for us right there, born as creatures of instinct to be captured and killed, reviling where they have no knowledge, will in the destruction of those creatures also be destroyed, suffering wrongs as the wages of doing wrong. They count it pleasure to revel in the daytime. They are stains and blemishes, reveling in their deceptions as they carouse with you, having eyes full of adultery that never cease from sin, enticing unstable souls, having a heart trained in greed, accused children, forsaking the right way. They have gone astray. They have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. But he received the rebuke of his own transgression for a mute donkey, one of the most stubborn animals out there. A mute donkey, speaking with the voice of a man, restrained the madness of a prophet. These are springs without water and mist driven by a storm, for whom the black darkness has been reserved. For speaking out arrogant words of vanity, they entice by fleshly desires, by sensuality, those who barely escape from the ones who live in error, promising them freedom while they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by what a man is overcome, by that he is enslaved. For if after they have escaped the defilements of the world by the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled in them and overcome, the last state has become worse for them than the first. For it would have been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than, having known it, to turn away from the holy commandment handed to them. It has happened to them according to the true proverb, a dog returns to its own vomit, and a sow after washing returns to wallowing in the mire. So in the midst of talking about dogs here, again, we're wrapped up into the behaviors of pigs and donkeys and untamed animals, all wrapped up right here. And it doesn't paint a good picture, does it? That's pretty much the lesson here. And I chose the dog the last because it, at least in the passages I brought up, it creates the greatest juxtaposition, right? The behavior of a dog when it comes to crumbs on the floor and the behavior of a dog when it comes to returning to its own vomit. It pretty much sums up your choices tonight. Do you want just whatever, just the littlest bit of what God will give you, which is everything, by the way? Whatever God will give you is enough. I think we have abundant examples of that. Or are you going to throw it up, throw all your the sins you've put off of you, which in this example is the dog vomiting, are you going to go and eat that again? It's pretty powerful, isn't it? If you have a need from the saints here at the Valley Congregation tonight, please come forward as we stand and sing.